Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio on this Tuesday, the 3rd of July. First hour of the program today, the political party that ruled Mexico for a long, long time with what some have described as an autocratic grip has found itself in power again after 12 years in opposition. What were the voters concerned about? The winner, Enrique Peña Nieto, had a comfortable victory. He is with the Centrist Institutional Revolutionary Party, known as the PRI, and it was thought to have been done for after its defeat in the 2000 presidential election, which ushered in a time of multi-party democracy. He is very photogenic, and maybe that had something to do with it. Who knows? But also voters must have been unhappy with the direction of the country. The PRI defeated the incumbent conservative party and the candidate who almost beat the conservatives last time, the left-leaning party, the Democratic Revolution. And I think they may have been on the rise shortly before this election. I'm wondering if the election were held a couple months down the road, if the outcome would have been different. There's a very interesting for those of you keenly interested in this, and it's important to the whole world, actually, this election. But the new president has an op-ed piece in today's New York Times, which is worth a read. He says that he wants to put fears to rest, that his election signifies a return to the old ways of his party. Let's put such worries to rest, he writes. He also writes about what he's going to do to fight crime and drug crime particularly. He calls on the United States to do more to curtail the demand for drugs. And he also talks about immigration reform. We'll touch on that this hour, saying that he would welcome the implementation of comprehensive immigration reform in the United States. We have two guests with us this hour who are experts on this part of the world. Tracy Wilkinson is Mexico Bureau Chief for the LA Times. Tracy, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thank you.
Hi. And Guillermo Trejo is with us as well, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Duke University. Guillermo, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure doing your show.
Great to have both of you here. Is it fair to say that this political party, the PRI, did rule for a long, long time with an autocratic grip? Two questions. How has Enrique Peña Nieto explained a different path for the PRI? And are there some people in Mexico worried that there will again be an autocratic grip? Tracy?
Well, yes, I think there are people in Mexico still worried about that. The PRI's great talent through its many decades of rule was that it used force and repression when it had to, but most of the time it was co-opting and coercing and buying off unions and any potential opposition. So that's what they were particularly good at, and I'm sure some of those techniques are going to return. However, the PRI leadership now is at least the most visible part of it is a younger generation that is insisting that it is reformed, that it learned the lessons of the past, it learned humiliation in its defeat first in 2000 and then a very bad defeat in 2006. But, you know, a lot of the old guard, as they call them here, the dinosaurs, are still there in the PRI, and they're right behind the scenes. They still have a certain amount of a great amount of influence, and so I guess that's the big question is: to what extent will they be pulling the strings? To what extent can Peña Nieto and the newer generation really change the course of policy and of governance?
Guillermo Trejo, you wrote an interesting article about the rise of a social media-based student movement that really seemed to be gaining a lot of fans recently, led by students from the country's leading private universities in Mexico City. The winner wasn't their candidate, but tell me about that movement and what role they play right now. And if indeed the election had been a few months down the road, the outcome may have been different.
Well, I think one of the most surprising results of this election is that the PRI didn't get a landslide. Everyone was expecting the PRI to get a margin of victory somewhere between 12 to 20 points, maybe get a majority in Congress, a majority in the Senate, and that was not good news. because the PRI would have returned to power without the appropriate checks and balances. And I think one of the greatest contributions of the student movement, this is a movement led by students for from Mexico's Mexico City's private universities, and lately from public students from public universities have joined the group, is that they really put their finger on what could be problematic with an election of Enrique Peña Nieto. And, and that is the fact that he would have few checks and balances, and most important of all, he would have Mexico's TV duopoly, Mexico's two major television networks that control up to 95% of television audience behind him. And that's really good, not good news. I mean, we've seen presidents who are very efficacious at combating crime and who renew economic growth, who bypass Congress, and with the aid of television networks, they become Vladimir Putin, or they become leaders like Carlos Saúl Menem in Argentina, and that would have been pretty bad for Mexico. So the main contribution of the student movement was to become a wake-up call, and we do have evidence that the movement has a major impact in terms of reducing the margin of victory. The margin of victory turned out to be 6%, and lots of independent voters and lots of young voters had second thoughts at the end about their support to Peña Nieto. So more checks and balances is the good side of this story.
Mm-hmm. Tracy, Guillermo has said in his recent piece that Mexico could be the next Russia and Peña Nieto the Mexican Putin. What do you think of that?
Yes, we talk about that a lot down here, the Putin model. I think that I don't think that Peña Nieto will necessarily come in and, you know, pull an Hugo Chavez or try to, you know, do as some leaders in the region have done and rewrite the Constitution to allow them to be, you know, perpetually reelected. You know, Mexico does not have reelection. The president may never succeed himself. But, you know, the PRI doesn't really have to. They will always have a candidate they can put up to assure that they win elections or, you know, at least have a shot at winning elections and thus can sustain themselves in power. And that is the concern, then, that you have this party that won't leave again for another seven decades. Now, to be just devil's advocate, the more optimistic view here is that, well, you know, Mexico has changed in the last 12, 14 years, that there are stronger institutions such as the Supreme Court. It's important, and media, aside from the television that Guillermo mentioned, which is very true, it's very much in basically the hands of two companies, but there are some pretty pretty feisty print media and, of course, the social media. But also the other important thing here, as Guillermo mentioned, the margin was only 6.5%, and the PRI will not have an outright majority in Congress. So they don't have a completely free hand. They will have to negotiate with other parties. So that's an important potential check on their power. The institutions here are stronger than they used to be. I'm still not sure they're strong enough to resist a lot of the pre influence and domination, but there are a few good signs there.
He writes in today's New York Times, Enrique Peña Nieto, that his generation's objective is measurable success at liberating Mexicans from poverty. And he goes on to say, that is how I governed the state of Mexico, the country's most populous, from 2005 to 2011. Guillermo, is that indeed how he governed the state of Mexico?
Well, I think there's a very strong piece of evidence in the election that he did not win, he did not carry his own state. It was the left that won that state. Mm. And if you look back, I mean, Enrique Peña Nieto really comes from a family of politicians who have dominated the state of Mexico for the past half century. And these are politicians who are well known for using public office for purposes of private enrichment. There's evidence that when Peña Nieto was Secretary of Finance under the governorship of his political godfather, a lot of what he did was to cook the books in such a way that there was no evidence of fraud and corruption once his godfather stepped for the governorship. Of course, Peña Nieto became the governor, and that wasn't an issue. As a governor, I think he surrounded himself by a very talented group of economists, some of them with PhDs from MIT, and they did well on the finance part. But in terms of rule of law and in terms of human rights, the record is actually pretty bad. We know that Ciudad Juárez is known to be, and Chihuahua is known to be, as the state with the largest, the greatest numbers of feminicides in the country. Well, the state of Mexico under Peña Nieto went ahead. It is now, if you are a Mexican woman, that's the worst place to be in the country right now. Cartels just took control over chunks of the state of Mexico, and levels of violence just skyrocketed.
Oh my.
There's evidence of human rights violations, the way he treated some social movements. But all that being said, I don't believe that there's some authoritarian element in his DNA. I know that that's the record. I think what's most important now is that there's lots of checks and balances.
Mm-hmm.
For me, I go back to the result. The fact that 60% of Mexican voters did not support the PRI is absolutely important. And it's been, to some extent, an element that he's had to internalize. The way the PRIistas spoke and Peña Nieto spoke 3-4 weeks ago is very different from the way they speak right now.
Hmm.
Because it was a great surprise to see that they didn't get a landslide. So at the same time, I don't want to take all these checks and balances for granted. Many commentators here in the U.S. and in Mexico say that Mexico has changed, the PRI may not have changed, but Mexico is different. Well, Mexico, as Tracy was saying, is slightly different.
Mm-hmm.
Mexico is not a strong democracy. It's not established democracy. It's an illiberal democracy. And what do I mean by an illiberal democracy? The rule of law doesn't work. The judicial system doesn't work. It's very difficult to get politicians to hold them accountable, so on and so forth. So it's a country in which human rights violations against journalists and against others in the context of the war of drugs has skyrocketed to levels similar to countries undergoing civil wars.
Mm.
So there's that element in which Mexican institutions, yes, we have an electoral commission that has proven to be quite an effective institution. We have a Supreme Court that is increasingly independent. We have a Freedom of Information Act that, with all the constraints there are in Mexico, governors and members of the military do not want to release information. But there are institutions that represent checks and balances. And there's civil society, the renaissance of Mexico's civil society in the past 2 years. But still, we cannot assume that those checks and balances will effectively constrain Peña Nieto. We really have to push farther for farther reforms, greater checks and balances, and pressure from outside and from below to democratize and establish the rule of law in Mexico.
Tracy, let's move to the drug war. You wrote recently, 6 years into this ghastly drug war, none of the top candidates offered a significant new strategy to win the conflict that has claimed more than 50,000 lives and terrorized Mexican society. In the time since you wrote that, has there been a plan put out there?
Well, all of the candidates spoke of reducing violence, particularly homicides, kidnapping, and extortion. And I think that was mostly to sort of, you know, and with all due respect, pander to the electorate that wanted to hear that and wants violence reduced. But if you really looked at the programs that they were proposing, there wasn't a lot of difference, at least in the short and medium term, from what the government of Felipe Calderón has been doing. For example, none of the candidates was recommending removing the army from the cities and regions where it is patrolling and fighting drug traffickers, fighting the cartels. the Peña Nieto has proposed, in fact, putting even more boots on the ground. He's proposed forming a gendarmerie that would be composed of former military, former soldiers under civilian command. That will take a long time. You know, the candidate said that, you know, the army has to stay deployed until an effective police force is up and running, which is something that Calderon was also attempting to do, or saying he was attempting to do. Mm-hmm. But that will take a very long time, however you go about it. Peña Nieto also said he would appoint a well-known Colombian police chief to be his special advisor. That was clearly a signal to the United States that he plans to continue with the same kind of cooperation with the United States and the same general tactics, frankly. So in the short and medium term, no, I don't think we can expect the dynamic to change substantially. The concern about the PRI, you know, the old PRI, it was always said that they were able to deal with drug traffickers by essentially making deals with them in exchange for peace and for payoff. And Peña Nieto has had to struggle to reassure audiences both here and in the U.S. that is not the case. They won't return to that sort of tactic. But, it, you know, again, on the state level, state to state, it would be a possibility that could happen. That said, it's also harder to make deals with the cartels today because there are so many more of them and a lot of smaller organizations all over the country that their activities are either drug trafficking or people trafficking or kidnapping or some form of organized crime, violent organized crime, and so cutting deals with them is a harder thing to do. But so far, you know, beyond those points, we haven't seen a very detailed plan for really turning this terrible violence around.
He did mention in his comments that were printed today, Peña Nieto, Professor Trejo, that he mm-hmm. wants the United States to do more to curtail demand for drugs. Do you see the United States responding to that, and do you see more information forthcoming from him about how to do that?
I mean, I think that's a demand that, regardless of which party, it's the PRI, the PAN, the PRD, pretty much all political forces in Mexico agree that, and critics of the Mexican government agree also that there's got to be something substantially different in dealing with demand in the U.S., demand for drugs, and also the supply for weapons. And on that front, you will find a consensus in Mexico. Where you don't find a consensus in Mexico is on ways to deal with this. And what was very surprising, as Tracy was saying about the election, and this is something that we should really get back to the candidates and to the different political parties on this, is that despite the nearly 60,000 casualties, the thousands of forced disappearances, the thousands of people who've been displaced from their homes, no one really had anything substantively to say about policy proposals on how to deal with the drug wars. I mean, this really was the elephant in the room. The only moment in which the issue was addressed publicly for a couple of days is when the peace movement managed to get all the candidates, and one by one, the leader of the peace movement pretty much asked them to apologize for their failure, to all political parties, for their failure to deal with drug issues and victimization at the federal and at the state level. It was a very peculiar moment in the campaign in which the peace movement, the leader, pretty much shamed all of Mexico's political class and asked them for a public apology. That was the only moment in which something was discussed or said. But otherwise, it wasn't an issue in the campaign. I'm not surprised when you look at election outcomes, and this is something we'll start to see once we analyze surveys and results more carefully, is that indeed the economy played a big role here. Voters look back and said it's been a decade of sluggish economic growth. There's been economic stability, but not economic growth. But then there's the other element, particularly in regions of Mexico that have been devastated by the violence. I mean, in these regions, 60,000 deaths is really not a small thing. I mean, we've tended to minimize that in Mexico. We've gotten used to numbers of casualties. I mean, 60,000, just to give you a sense, in the 20th century, the average civil war in the 20th century produced 12,000 casualties. Mexico has produced already five times what the average civil war of the 20th century produced. I mean, this is just an alarming number of casualties.
Yes, it is alarming.
A human tragedy that right. We have to deal with it as a continental problem.
Yeah.
This is an issue of supply, transit, and demand. And we really have to take this as an issue. This is no single country will be able to solve this issue.
Tracy, you talk about Washington, our country, working with the Calderon administration, providing intelligence and training, expanding its presence in Mexico, a lot of personnel from the CIA and the Drug Enforcement Administration, Treasury Department. Will that relationship continue and expand to take to fight this kind of violence?
I think all indications so far, yes, is that it will continue. As I mentioned, the appointment of this Colombian former top police chief, General Naranjo, indicates that they want to have that the new government will want to have a close relationship with Washington. So yes, I think it will continue. I think that the assistance and the intelligence that the United States provides has been very useful. The Calderon administration has been able to make some important arrests because of it and that sort of thing. But it is true, the demand from Peña Nieto that the United States do more about demand is an old, it's a demand that has been made here for many years by many, many Mexican politicians and governments, as Guillermo mentioned, and also that the United States do more to stop the flow of weapons into Mexico from the United States. Those are two things that they've just harped on and harped on, and there's really been very little progress.
We're going to welcome phone calls for both our guests. This hour, we're talking about the elections in Mexico. Voting took place on Sunday, and the winner was announced yesterday. Enrique Peña Nieto of the PRI party, the Institutional Revolutionary Party, which ruled Mexico for a long, long time, went out of power about 12 years ago, and now they are back. He says he's of a different generation and as a different kind of person and will be a different kind of president. So join our conversation if you would like. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. And you can also go to our Facebook page and leave messages on this if you would like. That's the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Next hour of our program, a really interesting book. A young Midwestern girl graduated from the University of Minnesota back in 1957. Very accomplished writer herself, got a job as a receptionist at the New Yorker in 57 and spent the next 21 years there. She simultaneously got her PhD. She is now emeritus professor of English at the State University of New York at Plattsburgh, and she's taught at Vassar, University of Cincinnati, and various other places. She talks about some of the famous personalities who wrote for the magazine and about her coming of age, too, in the receptionist in education at the New Yorker. That's our number two. All right, to your phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. Our guests are Professor Guillermo Trejo, assistant professor of political science at Duke University, and Tracy Wilkinson, who is Mexico Bureau Chief for the LA Times. We start our calls with Paul in Elkhorn. Hi, Paul.
Hi. Part of the thing that is the supply and demand, as they said, but if we sealed our borders or did a better job of border security, then the guns flowing south and the drugs flowing north would be a little easier to interdict. in addition, blaming the guns on the United States is kind of silly, because the United States obviously has many more guns than Mexico, but we don't go have see these street gunfights with 60,000 people being killed. So, I mean, just the availability of weapons isn't the issue. It's the lawlessness of that, as well as the porous borders.
Professor Guillermo Trejo, you want to take that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a very good it's a very good observation. But we have evidence that when the ban on assault weapons was not put into effect when it expired, the ban on assault weapons that President Clinton introduced in the 1990s, expired in 2004-2005, we have compelling evidence of a dramatic rise in violence in Mexico, particularly in northern counties in Mexico. That being said, I absolutely believe that weapons would be just a part of the story, the supply of weapons, the availability of weapons. The other side of the story is exactly what the viewer is pointing out, that there is domestic elements in Mexico and in Central American countries and in South American countries that explain why young men are recruited into gangs, the formation of cartels, why politicians protect and provide networks of protection for those criminals, so on and so forth. So that's why I talk about continental issue. That's why I talk about demand, supply, and transit. There's a lot that needs to be done in terms of changing the rule of law, ending the impunity of politicians who protect many of these drug cartels. And I think that's when many of us are skeptical about the PRI coming back to power. Not because they would try to sign a pact or come to an agreement or come to a new understanding with the drug cartels. As Tracy was saying, this conflict is far more complicated to reach an agreement. In the past, there were 4, 5, 6, 7 cartels. Now we have a multiplicity of not just cartels. We have mafias. We have private militias. We have paramilitary groups. We have rackets and racketeers. I mean, this has become a quite complex problem that you cannot just come to an agreement with. My point is that, or my skepticism come on the side of impunity. We need to subject to the law those politicians from which we have evidence that they cooperated with the narcos, or that we have evidence that they set up protection networks. And there's prosecution going on here in the U.S. against governors, one specific former governor of the state of Tamaulipas, south of the Texas border, and there is suspicion, there's no legal case yet, that a series of governors from the PRI, from the 1990s and from the past decade, were involved in different types of networks. Mm. One of those former governors, who's suspected to have had some type of link, was a candidate for the Senate from the state of Tamaulipas. The good news is that he didn't win. So voters are, to some extent, saying something. We need to do something about these politicians, and we need to continue pressuring Peña Nieto and the PRI to actually end the impunity regardless of party.
I want to ask you a little bit, Tracy, about media coverage of all of this as we enter a season here of huge amounts of money in the United States and nonstop ads, et cetera. How do Mexicans conduct their elections? And there was some talk, you may have written this, that there were charges of the TV networks having biased coverage in Mexico. How did the election unfold?
Well, yes, that was the contention, that particularly the largest television network here, Televisa, enjoyed a very cozy relationship with Peña Nieto and the PRI, and some would even argue helped build him into a candidate, helped make him a candidate. He was very much an image-driven candidacy, and that clearly had an impact. There is a lot of question about some of the surveys, opinion polls, to what extent they are also paid by political interests.
Really?
So television coverage, I mean, there are these rules whereby the equal time has to be given to all candidates. in the period of the campaign, but, you know, leading up to the campaign, that did not mean, that was not necessarily followed. The Televisa broadcast lots of very favorable ads and some would say coverage of the Peña Nieto governorship, which, you know, helped create his image and further create his image. On the other hand, the, you know, some of the newspapers are quite good at following the campaign and covering these candidates. You know, there's a leftist press and there's the more conservative press, as in the United States. But it's media. I mean, TV is what reaches most Mexicans, and it did. I mean, I think Peña Nieto looked very good on TV.
Oh, he's a good-looking guy, no doubt about that.
There's that too. There's that too. And of course, his wife is a well-known soap opera star, so she also had an air of glamour about her.
Right.
That was superficially very, very appealing. The difference here, unlike the United States, there are limits here on spending, and the government gives money to the candidates that they are not supposed to do a large amount of private fundraising. They're allowed a percentage, but it's in theory controlled. Of course, everyone gets around that, and the PRI is especially good at getting around that, at using donated airplanes that they argue they don't have to report because it's a donation and that sort of thing. So there's a lot of money in the campaign, even though officially it's meant to be controlled. The leftist candidate, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, has come out last night and claimed that, you know, more than 1 million votes were paid for, that the PRI used all of its old tactics you know, giving people money to show up and vote. And he continues to contest the results of this election and says that he will challenge it legally.
Is it true, were people paid to vote?
Oh, yeah, it happens.
It happens.
Certainly. They're paid or they are given, you know, literally bags of cement. I mean, that was always the old tactic. And we saw it again in the state of Mexico election last year. They are given discount cards for, you know, the local grocery store, or they're told if they take their cell phone in and take a picture of their ballot showing that they cast it for the party, they can then collect some money. So it definitely happens, you know, and I think it always has, even though there have been some important legal electoral reforms in Mexico in 2007 after the last presidential race. It's still not enough to stop a lot of this kind of coercion.
Bill in Madison, hi.
Hello. It seems like both sides of the border, there's a lot of political platitudes passed back and forth, but it seems like as far as demand side is concerned in the United States, we already have it. It's extremely illegal. I mean, the criminal justice system penalties for possession and distribution of drugs are so punitive, yet the demand is still so strong. There's really nothing the U.S. can do anymore as far as that's concerned. As far as guns are concerned, it's just too profitable. I don't think the United States is ever going to get much of a handle on guns because there's too many people in the United States who make a lot of money from it. Now, on the other side of the border, I've spent some time down in Mexico, and my experience is that the culture of corruption is so ingrained. You know, public servants are paid very little, and so it's very difficult for them to make a living without taking some money on the side, and people expect it, and it's no one knows who they can trust. So you can't, if you decide you want to stand up against the cartels, you don't know who you can trust.
Professor Guillermo Trejo.
Yeah, I think there's a huge question of exactly of trust, who to trust. Think just of the case of victims, any victims of crime in Mexico. Most crime in Mexico goes unreported, 90% of it. Victims just don't take. Here in the U.S., if something happens to you in the streets, you go to public authorities and make the case, even press charges. In Mexico, 90% of people just give up on going to public authorities. And one of the big problems is that you really don't know what public authorities will do with the information you bring to them, because they are either too ineffective to do anything worthwhile your time, or they are colluded with organized crime. So, of course, there's the issue, I repeat, there's the issue of demand, there's the issue of supply of guns in the U.S., but there's those critical issues of the rule of law in Mexico. And something that we need to bear in mind is that we lost a great opportunity in the last 12 years under Panista administrations. In the last 12 years, most countries that end long periods of authoritarian rule, say Mexico lived under an authoritarian regime for 7 decades. If you think of many other cases around the world, countries that come to that put an end to autocracy, one of the key questions to newly elected democratic leaders is whether they will look into the past or not. These are called mechanisms of retroactive justice, by which leaders look back and punish those who violated human rights or those who were corrupted under authoritarian rule. Unfortunately, in Mexico, we lost that opportunity. And we know from experience from around the world that those countries that fail to look back and punish those politicians and officials and security officials that under authoritarian rule violated human rights or protected criminals, if those guys survive, they are more likely to get engaged with organized crime under democracy. And if you don't establish a culture by which corruption is punished, in which impunity reigns, you are less likely to do anything in terms of combating crime. I doubt very much that Enrique Peña Nieto will look back into the years of the PRI and bring to justice those who violated human rights under the long years of the PRI.
Tracy, let me ask you, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this because we're still trying to get the facts on it, but the ATF's program Fast and Furious, as you well know, has been getting a lot of attention here. The with Eric Holder, et cetera, U.S. Border Patrol agent Brian Terry killed from one of the guns that the ATF allowed to walk across the border. Is this Fast and Furious program controversial in Mexico? Is it something the press is dealing with, that you're dealing with?
Well, we certainly have dealt with it a lot at the Los Angeles Times, but in Mexico, there was initial outrage, I suppose. The government has insisted it was never informed. The Mexican government has insisted it was never informed about what was happening. We sat down with the attorney general, and she said that she, you know, the first she was hearing of it was in newspapers and that sort of thing. So she, so there was that kind of dismay, I suppose. Several hundred weapons have shown up at Mexican crime scenes, including the murder of a state prosecutor's brother in Chihuahua. So there certainly is some, you know, anger that this has happened. On the other hand, they also say that these guns are a drop in the bucket compared to, you know, the vast quantities that come over. So I think they put it in perspective that way here in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
But I do agree with what Guillermo was saying. Impunity and lack of accountability, lack of rule of law are really, I think, some of the greatest problems facing Mexico. Not only, as he mentioned, is crime vastly underreported, it's also that those crimes that are reported are vastly underinvestigated. Of those 50,000 plus deaths, we don't know who most of those people are because the crimes were never investigated even. So it really goes very deep into
right. Right, very deep, very wrong. Let's move to immigration for a moment. The new president says experts agree there are more Mexicans coming back to Mexico than those leaving to find jobs in the U.S. This new reality should make the immigration debate in the United States less divisive. What do you think about that, Guillermo Trejo?
I think that's an inflection point in the recent history of immigration to this country, and that should that's an issue that should be debated quite profusely in the U.S. It's an issue that's being debated in Mexico, and that should be a point of caution for the PRI and Peña Nieto, because we know that traditionally people who left Mexico in the 90s and in the first decade of the 21st century, they were for the most part anti-PRI. So if people stop coming to the U.S. or start returning to Mexico, these are opposition voters. And there's got to be economic opportunities for them. These are populations who will be far more demanding, and this is something that he really needs to take into account. Beyond the rhetoric that most government authorities in Mexico from all political parties sympathize with Mexican immigrants, but they rarely do something substantive and press far enough to deal with this issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, Tracy, how is the economy? Is it really sluggish or is it picking up?
Just to add on to Guillermo's point, it's interesting to note that the vote overseas of Mexicans living overseas, the PRI lost big time.
Really?
And the PAN party, Calderón's party, with its candidate Josefina Vázquez Mota, won. So that just shows you. And then the left was a very strong second. So that shows you exactly what Guillermo's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
That those are people who probably left during the PRI. And,
right.
And there was a reason for it. The economy, I think it was best said, stable over these last years, but sluggish. It's not been growing at the same level of other Latin American countries. Mexico, of course, is very tied to the United States, so when the U.S. economy suffers badly, so does the Mexican economy. They've been able to come back a bit, but they still are, growth is well below what it could have been, what many say it should be. So economy is what Peña Nieto stresses is his main priority. He's going to talk about reforming Pemex, bringing foreign investment into Pemex, which has always been something of a taboo subject here, changing labor laws, tax codes, those kinds of things. So he's certainly, looking at the economy as a big challenge. But again, a lot of this remains to be seen.
What is Pemex?
Oh, I'm sorry, Pemex, the oil company, the state oil company that was nationalized many decades ago and is sort of a symbol of national pride, but it's hurting. It needs investment to be able to do some of the more expensive exploration that it needs to do. It's a major revenue earner for the state, obviously, but it is also performing sluggishly. So they are looking at how to do something about that. Of course, it was the PRI that resisted when Calderón tried to make these reforms in the Pemex. So, whether Peña Nieto will pull it off is a big question.
We're talking about the Mexican elections this hour, and our phone number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and you can also leave a message on our Facebook page if you'd like to, The Kathleen Dunn Show. A couple lines are open for you right now. Bill, thanks for your call. We'll be with more of you in a moment. Our guests this hour are Guillermo Trejo, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Duke University, and Tracy Wilkinson, Mexico Bureau Chief for the LA Times. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program on this Tuesday, the author of The Receptionist, an Education at the New Yorker. Janet Groth is our guest. While she was at the New Yorker, she also went on and got her PhD. She's now emeritus professor of English at the State University of New York at Plattsburgh. But it's an interesting time that she writes about. She started in 1957 and had a lot of talent as a writer, as you can tell from what happened in the rest of her life. But she was at a time before the feminist movement in this country and stayed a receptionist for all of those years. E.B. White actually asked her if she could type. Typing is a good thing to know how to do, but she could obviously do a lot more things than type. We have some lines open if you want to join our conversation about the election in Mexico. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and our email is talk@wpr.org. Professor Guillermo Trejo, I have read, and you follow this very closely, that the new president really conducted this campaign without much of an ideological bent. He presented himself, I'm your pragmatic manager, I'm going to get things done, et cetera. Is that a fairly general assessment, though, of the way that he campaigned, and so it's maybe hard to know how he will govern?
Well, there's some elements. I mean, we do have his public record, which we can say that he's surrounded by a fairly good group of economists. So we expect on that front, he's already talked about the need for structural reforms in Mexico. As Tracy was saying, he's going to be pushing for major reforms to open explorations of oil in Mexico to the private sector and to international investors. It seems to be that he's pushing for a fiscal reform to increase the value added tax. Mexico's fiscal situation is pretty bad. We depend a lot on oil, and we need to depend more on tax revenues. He's pushing for a series of other reforms that are interesting. Nonetheless, those reforms will be quite contested. Most people disagree that Mexico needs an increase in the value-added tax. If you think technically about the problem, that kind of makes sense, but voters don't want that. Opening Pemex, Mexico's state-led oil company, to private investment in exploration will be quite contentious. So there's a series of reforms he's already announced. He's pretty much selling to the world the language he's using towards international communities, that he will be the type of very effective leader, market-oriented leader, as one of his political godparents, President Carlos Salinas. He will be that type of leader, to take very bold actions, to take reforms that are far-reaching, but that are pretty much contested. So we know that. The big questions we have is on the rule of law, on security. We know very little of what they're going to do. It seems to be that what we hear is law and order, mano dura, the type of policies that governments have followed in Central and South America, in Colombia with some success, but with a very bad human rights record, with not very good success in Central America. He's pretty much selling that, law and order policies that to some extent were appealing to voters, specifically in northern states in Mexico. So we know more or less what he's going to do in terms of the economy. We don't know much what he's going to do in terms of the rule of law and in terms of the war on drugs. And the final point is that this election is not over yet. The leftist candidate has not consented. And
right.
This is something we have to keep in mind, because democracy is majority rule but with minority rights. And in all democracies, it's really the minority, the losers, who it's until they consent to the result that we are back to the usual game. And I think what's interesting about López Obrador contesting the result this time is that he's really signaled that he's going to follow the judicial process. He's not calling for major mobilizations. He's pretty much talking about looking carefully into how money was spent, the role of the media, as Tracy said, what happened on election day in terms of clientelism and vote buying, so on and so forth. I don't think there's a problem in Mexico in terms of the vote counting. I think Mexico's Federal Electoral Commission does the counting quite well. But there's many other problems in the campaign and with clientelism and vote buying. And rather than just say, okay, it's over, the election is over, Peña Nieto won, let's move on to the next issue, let's talk about the economy, I think we need to take care of this. Let's not forget that between 30% and 40% of Mexican voters believe that elections in Mexico are not clean.
All right, let's go to another phone call. We're running short on time. It's Cole we want to go to in Appleton. Hi, Cole.
Hi. My question is, with more than two strong parties in Mexico, is there any traction to move to a runoff system that would take the top few candidates and put them into a runoff situation?
Tracy, about a minute left.
Okay, good question. There was an effort to make some reforms in the electoral system. A runoff was something discussed. but that has gone nowhere, along with re-election as a possibility. That also has gone nowhere. So it's a question of whether Peña Nieto now will take up those same reforms.
And finally, an email. Somebody wants to know if tourism has been affected. A lot of people from America go to Mexico, of course. Tracy, how safe is it to travel in Mexico, just in big resorts or elsewhere?
Yeah, parts of Mexico are safe with, you know, normal precautions. Tourism is up. Mexico has had record tourism the last year or so, which seems, you know, somewhat contradictory to the situation. But I think if people come and stay in certain areas and take normal precautions, it's a pretty safe, it could be a pretty safe trip.
Well, thank you both so much. You were highly informative. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Our guest, Tracy Wilkinson, Mexico Bureau Chief for the LA Times, Guillermo Trejo, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Duke University. Thanks to Brett Jaspers for producing the hour. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Learned a lot that hour, huh? It was interesting. We have news coming up momentarily, and we will return and talk about being a receptionist at the New Yorker for 21 years, starting in 1957. Should be a fascinating hour. Stay with us on the Ideas Network.